Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hi, I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Joshua.
And I'm Pat.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series, too. We're going to take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. First item on the Doctor Who agenda is Temporal Grace, where we just discuss recent things we've encountered that we liked, somehow pertaining to the world of Doctor Who.
Well, guys, I am really excited about the news. It might be slightly old by the time this podcast goes out, but the news that Big Finish has a license to do new unit audio stories with Kate Lethbridge Stewart, which is really exciting to me. Obviously, as a geek, I like to see that overlap between old and new Who, and they have the potential to bring in old unit characters. They haven't announced a lot yet, but kind of do more of a mashup of old and new. And it also opens up a whole new world. I'm curious if this goes well and what obscure corners of New Who they can dig for entire box sets. I really want a Wilson audio box set. Wilson being the electrician who has died at the beginning of Rose. I can see Big Finish doing an entire box set on Wilson's last days, defending the department store from the Autons. This whole backstory, a prequel to the new series.
So similar to your Temporal Grace here, Josh, what I'm excited about, and this is looking forward to the future the same way that you are, is this new series of books that are coming out about Colonel Lethbridge Stewart. That is Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart, in the period between The Web of Fear and The Invasion.
The Lost Years.
The Lost Years, yes. Lethbridge Stewart, The Lost Years. This is all the function of the fact that elements of Doctor Who are owned piecemeal by the original writers who created this. It's not like I can't write something about Spider-Man just because I wrote a Spider-Man story or whatever, but if I was working on the classic series of Doctor Who and I'm Robert Holmes and I created the Santarans, I can license the Santarans to the Faction Paradox, or my estate can license them to the Faction Paradox people, or Terry Nation can license the Daleks independently of Doctor Who. So this is a function of that. Whoever created the Brigadier, or...
You can write Slash.
I don't think I need a license to do that, though.
Exactly.
My we all have license
Stewart
to Slash.
Spock Slash fiction is out there on the internet for everybody to find. But these are going to be books about that period in the Brigadier's life. They're not going to have any references to Doctor Who. But what's exciting about it to me is that in addition to a few names that I'm not familiar with, there are some genuinely good writers writing the books. Lance Parkin is writing one.
Ooh.
David McKinty is writing one, who wrote a number of Doctor Who books back in the day, including one of my favorites, The Face of the Enemy, which takes place in that period where the Doctor and Joe are off at Peladon, and the Brigadier has something to do, and he needs to work with the Master who's in jail to do it. So, but now I'm getting a little off topic, but so now I'm kind of nerding out about this whole thing.
You've got me excited about him.
Calvin?
I am excited for going to finally figure out what the heck happened to make the sixth Doctor regenerated the seventh Doctor.
Ooh, more they Big Finish
goodness,
stuff.
Yes.
That Big Finish has recorded something called The Last Adventure, which is the last sixth Doctor adventure. I mean, they will be making more sixth Doctor adventures, but this is...
He's going to get croaked.
That he gets croaked at the end.
And he'll have a proper last line, not characters, characters, characters.
So it's Colin Baker and Bonnie Langford and...
The Veilyard is
the
going to be included, which
seems
appropriate.
As official as Big Finish is.
It's getting more and more official,
though.
I mean, they're starting to... I mean, they've got a license to the new series. They had the companions name checked in Night of the Doctor with Paul McGann's regeneration.
Okay.
So this is sort of... You get a chance to hear Colin Baker have his, like, every Doctor gets their last, like, soliloquy as they're dying, and I think that's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, I think this is a little heartwarming, guys. All three of us picked something that is coming out. We're just excited about stuff that's coming out.
That's new, even though it's old new. Right. It's still new.
Yeah, it's
new. I feel young
it's
again.
New old stuff.
This makes a difference. God damn it. Well, this better be good, Kelvin, because it's your turn to do a special topics Dalek.
Oh, dear me. Okay.
So what's it going to be, son?
Something I've been thinking about lately. What do you think the Doctor loses and or gains each time he regenerates? Personality obviously changes fairly significantly, but the Third Doctor knew Venusian Akido. None of the other Doctors have displayed this ability. Now, is that strictly a taste thing because of the Doctor's personalities being different? Or did he just flat out, like, lose the memory of how to do that and somehow, in quasi-mystical fashion, gain it when he regenerated from the Second Doctor to the Third Doctor?
We're treading very close to philosophical ideas about what makes a person who they are here. I remember Peter Davison and the Five Doctors as his memories are getting stripped from him. Because the time scoop has been taking out his earlier incarnations, saying, you know, a man is the sum of his memories, a Time Lord even more so.
Yes.
And it's an interesting question to examine a little bit, too. Like, what makes us the same person from day to day? Mm-hmm. Is it our bodies? We could lose part of our bodies and still be the same person, right? Is it our memory? You know, is it the fact
it's
that we...
Philip K. Dick kind of...
Yeah, is it the fact that we have a memory of who we were that it gives us the idea that we are the same person now as we were 20 years ago?
Well, like when he regenerates, he gets an entirely new body, which I would think would presume an entirely new brain. You know, an entirely new setup of neural connections that may give him entirely different insights, but also entirely... lose other ones.
But the body-mind works together, so in the case of John Pertwee, he might have, like you said, learned Venusian karate as a young William Hartnell doctor somewhere, and he just hadn't had the physique to pull it off until he is the Third Doctor. I can't imagine physically...
He's supposed to be one of the very few two-armed beings to have learned it.
Yep.
He must be different on a genetic level, too, if his body is changing. Assuming the Time Lord... DNA works anything like we do.
Yeah.
Some of the incarnations may be more adept at running fast, doing Venusian Akido.
Doing Sudoku. Better. Or something.
Differently developed moral senses. I don't know.
I've never thought of it this way, but there's like no nurture. It's all a nature argument. Then you regenerate and he has these personality traits locked in to a certain degree, and the Doctors don't change a lot.
So much of this is trying to make sense of something that inherently doesn't make any sense, or it's just a function of what the production teams are doing.
Yeah.
Because to suggest that the young William Hartnell doctor spent a lot of time learning Venusian Aikido stretches credulity here. You know, even what we know of William Hartnell...
Even in a Doctor Who podcast, stretches it.
Well, he's not a well-traveled person in Unearthly Child and the adventures after that. There's a suggestion that he's left Gallifrey fairly recently. But your point remains.
Yes.
So, like, what is it about the Doctor that changes, and how much does it change?
Yeah. This energy is pulled from somewhere. It does a complete genetic rewrite of the body it's focused on. Completely different brain, completely different physical possibilities.
Yeah, they act different. They have different beliefs. The only thing that seems to be the same is the memories.
Yeah. And even then, I wonder if, like, he just forgets...
They do that all the time in the show. Oh, I forgot this. I forgot.
Yeah.
The face of evil, or Tom had forgotten that he was on Leela's planet before.
It, you know, it brings up the possibility that, like, maybe the 12 regeneration limit is just sort of a custom that the Time Lords evolved, because once you get beyond 12 regenerations, you just run the risk of kind of maybe going senile because your brain has been reconfigured so many times.
There's also a suggestion that Time Lords in a safer environment can change their form with a lot more control, and there appears to be less character change between Romana's two regenerations. And there's something I like about the idea that the Doctor is being reckless with these lives, and some of the changes in his personality are due to the fact that he is having these violent deaths, and that in Time Lord society, you wouldn't be having all these dangerous situations in which you would have regenerations due to radiation poisoning or falling off of things or all the various ways he's died.
You live out a natural lifespan,
yep.
And then, oh, it's time to regenerate, I guess, and now I'm a kid again.
The regeneration between 11 and 12 wasn't a violent one.
old age.
It's old age, pretty much. But then again, you're only supposed to have 12 regenerations. All bets are off at that point?
I don't know. This might be a question for science.
Yeah. Why can't science answer my fanish questions, I ask you?
There's a lot of fundamental questions about identity that pop up in Doctor Who, and this is really close to the heart of it, too, because if we accept regeneration as a fact, then what is it about the various Doctors that make them the same person in any real sense? I would say not very much.
Yeah.
They have some patterns of behavior that are the same. They're generally heroes, but even that gets stretched in different ways. So it's really the memories that keep them together. But is it any different, Kelvin, than that time that I took your memory onto a memory stick and plugged it into my brain?
You have an illegal copy of me.
I have an illegal copy of you in my brain.
You have a bootleg of me.
But you wouldn't call me Kelvin in any sense. I'm just Pat with Kelvin's memories, right?
What
memories are they? Oh, boy.
More and more the new series is moving toward that idea that the old Doctor dies. I mean, in the David Tennant's regeneration, he seemed to explicitly say that within the narrative, that and a new man walks away.
I would assume, you know, regeneration is exactly like dying. It's not just reaching some sort of life Rubicon, like, oh, I graduated from college.
Right.
I'm an adult now or whatever. What was you dies.
So one of the great satisfactions of the show, I think, is that most of the Doctors get a real ending.
Mm-hmm.
The show can continue, but we get the tragic ending that we all have eventually in our lives and that all good stories should have. Related question, where do these bodies come from? So when John Pertwee becomes the Doctor, he is now in an older body with a tattoo on it.
Exactly.
When Colin Baker becomes the Doctor, he is a version of a character we've met before, Commander Maxill.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Capaldi is a character we've met before, too.
And he intimates a little hinting, like, where did this face come from?
I've seen this face before. Where is it? So does he copy Ramonet? Exactly did that. Mm-hmm. She copied Princess Astra. She took a copy of that body and made it her.
And hers is an intentional regeneration. She's chosen, being a fickle woman, has chosen to regenerate for no real reason of impending death. And so perhaps when you're in a serious situation, like you're dying, it's like a dream state. It just pulls from your subconscious. These are things. This is a tattoo somewhere in a Turkish bath the Doctor has seen somewhere.
Yeah. Isn't it mentioned in some novel or something that they tried to explain John Pertwee's snake tattoo that he got in his Navy days as a Time Lord brand placed on someone to indicate, you know, some sort of renegade?
So much mental energy expended in these gaps. That's wonderful. You know, that's terrific stuff.
There certainly doesn't seem to be a conservation of mass between regions.
No.
It's like, whoa, suddenly he grew a foot. Where did that come from?
See, I love this idea that, you know, these body patterns are stored in his memory somewhere, that they kind of come out when he needs to regenerate, and his subconscious cycles through the various bodies.
We could open up the gigantic can of worms that is the brain of Morbius and, like, the visions of other Doctors we see on the screen.
All right, that's it. We are closing this can right now.
I just want to see the Tom Baker episode where he lands and meets the rural British veterinarians and hangs out with them for an adventure and gets Tristan's pattern in his brain. And then, I'm going to write that.
Write it.
I'm going to write it for our next wonderfully functionalism.
That will be the one Doctor Who story my parents will watch.
And now we're at round three, guys, the randomizer. In this round, we discuss a randomly selected Doctor Who story. Today, we will be talking about 4-2 Doomsday.
Doomsday, yay. Doomsday, Doomsday.
It's a lot better when you say it like that.
Doomsday.
This is the second serial of the 19th season, and the first story that Peter Davison recorded, and it is not a really talked about episode.
I really love this one.
Make a case, sir.
It dates well. I think the look of it doesn't look as terrible.
It's really got nice sets.
It's a great set.
The opening shot of the spaceship is really nice, and it actually has a rare example of very atmospheric, minimalistic 80s music, too.
Monarch is a great villain. I think Stratford-Jones?
Stratford-Jones, yeah.
I think he's spectacular as Monarch. I liked the idea of conflict between the companions. I would have preferred if maybe it wasn't quite as shrill, maybe. But You know, I totally bought that Adric would think Monarch was a great guy, because too smart for his own good kid who hasn't had any real socialization in his life would be like, Monarch's plan sounds awesome.
Not so much gullible as idealistic,
yeah.
As the doctor says.
There's a lot of reasonable science in it that I think is at a good pitch to kids kind of level. You know, Nyssa shorting out the androids with the sonic screwdriver and a pencil. The doctor getting back into the TARDIS by throwing the cricket ball and catching it. And it's not violent at all. The only really violent thing I can think of is the gladiator combat between the ancient Greek robots for the recreation period.
Yeah.
But they're brought back to life.
Yeah.
They make a point of it. Tegan freaks out about it. She cries.
Yeah.
But
Tegan's kind of histrionic behavior is given some actual context of this episode. She's having a real reaction to these frog people are going to invade the planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to wipe everybody out. We've got to do something.
And she's freaked out that the doctor isn't more freaked out, but the doctor realizes this is a situation in contrast to the fourth doctor, where he has to be a lot more diplomatic, play it more casual and subtle.
Peter Davison is very different from what he's going to become. There's a lot of his character in it, but he seems extra boyish and kind of pleased with his boyish charm. He doesn't have any of the real exasperated quality he gets a lot later on. He's just kind of all exuberance and smiles, lots of big smiles. He's very appealing in it.
To qualify that a little bit, his exasperation is evident in his scenes with Matthew Waterhouse.
Yes.
This would have been the first adventure they filmed together, but even here, he can't even look at the kid. Yeah, he's chewing him out, and he's like looking past him, and look, it's awful. I gotta say that my favorite thing about this episode is how much you love this adventure. And I don't mean to say that in a patronizing way, but I've been listening to you talk, and I'm like, yeah, I can get that. And I see everything that you're saying, and it's opening up little blossoms inside my brain, because yes, all of that is true. So many of the superficial things, great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes.
Adric greats, Tegan greats. The pacing and the kind of all-over-the-place ideas sort of frustrate me.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. As a kid, I liked the cricket ball scene.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to the TARDIS. Just having characters called Enlightenment and Persuasion is wonderful. I like the multiculturalism.
It's a reasonable stab at multiculturalism.
Although the doctor has that terrible line about, I used to bowl a very good Chinaman, and then he looks at him and goes, whoops.
I don't know what bowling a Chinaman is, but I'm assuming it's like...
I thought it was a sexual thing. Did you guys...
I didn't think it was a sexual thing.
I'm assuming it's like a...
Either that or cricket.
I'm assuming it's like...
It's a cricket thing.
Oh, I'm assuming it's left-handed bowling.
But it's true. You know, where else but in Doctor Who can you have an audience of Greek hoplites, Australian Aborigines, and aliens watching a Mayan dance
at
a Chinese puppet show? It's like an evening at the Cedar Cultural Center.
It's kind of great in a weird way.
I love a lot about this episode. I'm with you. Like, the surface material is really great. Mm-hmm. I love the black eyes that follow them around and all the various tricks they use to get around them. I really actually like you said, some of the companion disagreements. But you have this problem where Monarch's goals are not the story.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to go invade Earth, but it's not an Earth invasion story.
But his real reason is...
But he wants to go backwards in time to meet himself because he thinks he's God.
Yes.
And none of that is really actually part of the action of the story. It's very static.
That's kind of what I liked about it, I guess, was that it was just this weird egomania thing he has. Like, well, clearly I'm God, you know? Like,
great idea, I agree. But the problem is, I think you enter the script before the dramatic part of the story has happened, and he's foiled before it gets anywhere near a climax.
I would like to see Monarch go back to the beginning of
time
and see whether he's God or not.
And does the doctor stop him there? Does the doctor go back in time with him or stop him from finding out that question? It needed a script editor to say, you both started and ended the story before there's a story.
Yeah, I think much of the plot is just discovering all of the details of the interesting ideas that are going on. And then just kind of resolving it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminded me of, you know, like the first episode of The Ark in Space. We're on this weird ship. What's going on? Why are these ancient civilizations here? That kind of geeky discovery thing. Another thing that kind of fascinates me about this story is, okay, you've got Monarch. He's got this super advanced technology. What he doesn't have is faster than light travel. and how time travel works.
That is mentioned at the end by the Doctor. He's like, faster than the speed of light wouldn't even have worked. Mm. Stupid monarch who's tiny over here.
Part of the issue that I have with it, and I don't hate it, I'm kind of neutral on it, but a lot of the interesting ideas seem very blurry to me, and I don't quite get them. Was that just aspirational of the monarch to go back through time? Because he's not making any efforts. He spent tens of thousands of years traveling back and forth in the ship without apparently attempting to go back in time.
I guess I just took it as, especially the way Stratford Johns plays him, he's just so egotistical and confident that he has no need even to do any kind of real big speech making or anything. You know, he doesn't go around like, well, I'm God, ha ha ha.
Yeah, he's not a maniacal villain.
Yeah, he's a very matter-of-fact acceptance of his own superiority.
Because that's what gets to me. Yeah. I think the performance is great. I think there's a lot of small things that are great, but it just doesn't deliver on the possible storylines it presents.
So what's it about? Monarch destroyed Urbanka by destroying its ozone layer. So it's got some
environmental
themes, and it's got some kind of singularity themes to it, where we're becoming cybernetic.
One of the things that really interests me about this episode was the interactions between the companions, and I don't know if it was accidental or just that it's the second episode of this season. They really underscored in this episode how frickin' damaged each one of these companions are. We get a mention that Tegan's aunt was murdered and shrunk before her eyes. Nyssa brings up the Master killing her father in Traken, and the Doctor points out that Adric is just kind of this lost kid who is an abandoned delinquent on his home planet. And you really get this idea that he's picked some losers. I mean, but they're all really damaged. And I don't remember these stories underscoring that as much going forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Tegan, emotional, maybe to a fault. Adric, intellectual, maybe to a fault. And Nyssa as sort of the deputy doctor.
But totally ineffectual, except with the pencil attack.
And Tegan is bizarrely presented in this one. She has some good moments, but I mean, on the one hand, she's a great artist, apparently. Blow your mind. Artist. She can converse with ancient aborigines, but she doesn't know what sodium chloride is or really understand time travel, because she keeps saying, you're going to lose me my job. And it's like, can someone just take her aside and go, we're in a time machine. I can get you back before you left.
There are too many people in the TARDIS, and the writers don't know what to do with them, and they hate at least half of them. And the writers clearly hate Adric. He spills the beans to Monarch. Mm-hmm. Emotionally, I understand what you're saying, Kelvin. Like, oh, he would be attracted to Monarch and his ideas or whatever, but the way it's presented, he has a several-minute scene where the Doctor is a Time Lord. He has two hearts. He has a machine that travels through time, and his dad was killed by the Master. And all he just keeps talking to the point where Nyssa tells him, shut up. And he keeps talking after that. Oh, it's just, you can tell the contempt that the writers had for this character. Even if Matthew Waterhouse had been a better actor, he doesn't stand a chance with this material.
He's right about women, though. They are mindless, impatient, and bossy. Let's give him that.
You know, I have to confess, I haven't really seen any Adric episodes in quite a long time, so his generally accepted annoyance factor among fandom, I don't really have that much of a memory or thing about it.
Doesn't stick in your craw.
Yeah.
Like, to me, I can see why Fort of Doomsday is not greatly remembered, but not greatly hated, because I can totally see what you're saying, Kelvin. It looks pretty, and there are great lines. The Doctor is exuberant and super charming in it, but it just is kind of inert plot-wise, so it's not going to excite anyone.
There's something very relaxed about it. I had it on, I was watching it, and I was kind of enjoying it, except at the really screechy Adric or Tegan moments. But yeah, it took me back to my childhood, and it's got an 80s look to it, and the stakes are very low. I grew up watching this, and it was not as interesting as Castrovalva, it was not as mind-boggling as Kenda, but I'm very far from hating this. This is really just kind of straight down the middle Doctor Who for me.
I find it an unjustly overlooked story.
And I love that too, because a part of the fun of doing this podcast to me is revisiting these things that you haven't watched in a while, and you're surprised about what episodes suddenly grab you again, and you have this renewed excitement over them.
Yeah,
and
who would have predicted that all three of us love Time and the Rani better than any other Sylvester McCoy episode? Listeners will have to look forward to that podcast.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, when that comes up.
guys. It's round four, Wonderful Afunctionalism. We're 9 episodes into this podcast, and you may have noticed that all the opinions so far expressed have come from middle-aged guys. That's why we decided to get a second opinion on Four to Doomsday. One from a 10-year-old girl. Listeners, here's my daughter, Miriam.
Hi, my name is Miriam, and this is my review of Four to Doomsday. I like the Fifth Doctor because he's not old and he wears celery. But I don't really like to eat celery, but I like that he wears it. My favorite part of the story was when the Fifth Doctor put his hat over the Monopticon. But overall, I thought the story was really weird. And this is basically how it went. So the Fifth Doctor was in the TARDIS, and then he was trying to get Tegan back to the airport, and then he landed, and he didn't get to the airport, and then there were these, like, green pimply guys watching him. Then the weird pimply guys, like, opened a door and let Tegan and the Doctor go through the door to the weird pimply guys, and then Nyssa was, like, messing around with the stuff, and then an old guy came and did something, and then it went back to the pimply guys, and then weird stuff happened, and then it turns out all the guys from different places were robots, and they tried to turn Nyssa into a robot, and then didn't work, and then they ran away into the TARDIS, and then Nyssa fainted. Dun, dun, dun. And Adric is totally sexist. He just totally just, like, said that women are, like, bossy and mindless. Ridonkulous. But a good thing, later on in Earthshock, he gets blown up by the Cybermen. In conclusion, it was a bit too weird and I didn't terribly like it. And I give it a thumbs down. One last thing. You know how I said the Fifth Doctor, I liked him because he wasn't old? Well, the Third Doctor is really awesome, and he is really old, but he is really awesome because he kicks butt and he can just, like, throw people around the room. He's, like, really awesome. So, yeah, I'm done.
And now it's time for our fifth and final round, The Death Zone. This episode, we're going to talk about some pretty obscure Doctor Who stuff. We're going to talk about the 1980s Doctor Who monthly comic series Voyager, starring Colin Baker as the Sixth Doctor and a companion named Frobisher, who we'll talk more about. And we're pairing this with the big finish Rob Shearman written audio, The Maltese Penguin, starring Frobisher, with appearances by Colin Baker. First, spoiler warnings for our listeners. One of the things about talking about the Big Finish audios, as opposed to talking about old classic Doctor Who, is that many people may not really be familiar with them. And in some cases, particularly here with The Maltese Penguin, some of the fun of it is in the surprise. So I would encourage people to go out and buy and listen to The Maltese Penguin before they listened to this, because we're going to spoil the heck out of it. So, Josh, Frobisher.
I love Frobisher. He is a whifferdill.
What's a whifferdill?
He is a shapeshifter. Yep. And in Voyager, the Doctor encounters him as a private eye, and he becomes the Doctor's comic strip companion. But quickly, in the second story, the beginning of the actual Voyager arc, Frobisher shapeshifts into a penguin and tells the Doctor that he's going to stay as a penguin for a while, for personal reasons, and then remains a penguin for, I think, most of the rest of the comic strip run.
Every now and then he'll switch into something else if the plot demands it.
Yep.
But 90% of the time he's a penguin.
Default penguin.
He's even a penguin in the audios, because he appears in two audios. I don't think we mentioned this.
Yes.
He appears in The Maltese Penguin, and he also appears in what is frankly my personal favorite Big Finish audio, Rob Shearman's The Holy Terror. also starring Colin Baker. But we'll save that discussion for another day.
And he is played in the audios by Robert Jezik, who was in Battlefield as a Russian unit officer.
Oh.
So this is the Death Zone, and both of these stories are going in, but only one is coming out. So we're going to talk about Voyager, and we're going to talk about the Maltese Penguin. Now, the one thing that we should talk about in relation to Voyager is that it's part of a longer-running continuity of the Doctor Who monthly comics.
Which is a bit different from...
the TV show.
Yeah.
It's a wider discussion that we could talk about more elsewhere, but it's kind of interesting to know that the comic strips had been running in Doctor Who. First it was Doctor Who Weekly, then it was Doctor Who Monthly, then it was Doctor Who Magazine, ever since Tom Baker was the Doctor. And they kind of generate this parallel Doctor Who continuity that has little or nothing to do with the show and can do wild and crazy things, especially visually, that the TV show can't. By this time in its run, it's generated its whole sort of continuity of its own. Frobisher is there because there's a contract out on the Doctor by the character Dog Bolter, because several episodes earlier, the Peter Davison Doctor had encountered Dog Bolter, and his companion at the time died at the hands of a person that Dog Bolter had hired, and it's all very complicated, and we won't get into that. But for purposes of our discussion here, we're bracketing off just a small part of the comics, the parts of the comics that introduced Frobisher, and we're putting it up against the Maltese Penguin. So after all of this preamble, almost 5 minutes of preamble, what's it about? What are these stories about?
I would really like to know. I read Voyager, and I'm like, what in the heck is going on?
Do your best to summarize for our listening audience what the heck is going on.
Oh, God. Frobisher, in his original form, which is like a little blank-faced yellow humanoid in a trench coat, and kind of hijacks the Doctor to Venus, which I guess is where Dog Bolter lives.
Dog Bolter's a frog, by the way.
Yeah, he's like a frog humanoid.
Don't let the dog part confuse you. He's a frog.
I'm assuming he's called Dog Bolter because he eats dogs, like, super fast.
He bolts them.
I don't know. I'm assuming that's his diet. I don't know.
That's your headcanon?
Yeah. But, God, I don't even remember what else. Then there's something
that's
with...
That's just the preamble.
So, they defraud Dog Bolter. Because that's one thing that the Doctor does in the comics. He defrauds people of lots of money.
That was a very weird moment. Yeah. And he demands half the money at the end of that.
Yeah, and then they wind up in the Antarctic, and they find a wrecked sailing vessel. They run into some...
Which the Doctor recognizes from his nightmares.
He's been having nightmares about being trapped on a sailing vessel. And they run into some guy named Astrolabus, who is some sort of other renegade Time Lord who, unlike the Doctor, is just flat-out insane, I guess.
When convenient for the plot, he is insane.
And he has stolen some sort of star chart from some utterly unexplained and mysterious entity called Voyager. There's some statement about, like, the Doctor is a Time Lord, but Voyager is a Life Lord, but they don't really explain what the hell that is. Oh, God, I don't even know what happens next. It's such a confusing story.
I think you're doing very well so far, so I'm going to pat you on the back and give you a little rub down, and I'll try to take over from here.
Oh, God.
Whew. So, listeners, Kelvin has done a good job of summarizing the first part of the story. We won't give away all of the later details, but Astrolabus becomes a recurring villain for the next few episodes. There's a brief deviation where the Doctor and Frobisher hang out with Dr. Ivan Asimov, an alien person who is in love with a giant space whale kind of thing called Polly. This is a story for another day. But eventually they run into Astrolabus again, and they go through his magic box, and they go into a land of fairy tales.
The story actually changes into, like, a storybook fairy tale format for several pages with, like, where it's in, like, rhyming couplets or something. And
I think that's key. We are explaining this comic strip out of context because it is a unified whole with the artwork. And I take it as an aesthetic piece. And John Ridgway is the artist, and I think the artwork is just really atmospheric and kind of haunting in places. And it is more stream of conscious, sort of dreamlike quality to it.
John Ridgway, he was the first artist on John Constantine Hellblazer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
And I guess that was part of my thing is that because I really associate his style with horror and in this kind of like very surrealistic, whimsical kind of story, it was just kind of a weird disconnect to see his style in that form.
Yeah, I think you guys are right. We've been kind of being a little goofy about it, but it has its own place in comics history from the mid to late 80s here. There's a lot of kind of spacey, surrealist panels that John Ridgway does that they're reminiscent of early Steve Ditko stuff.
It's
from
a lot like
Doctor
Strange. It reminded me a lot of like heavy metal.
Heavy metal comics, 2000 AD.
Yeah.
Specifically at the same period, Steve Bissett and John Totleben are doing weird things with scale in Alan Moore's Swamp Thing.
Right.
Steve Parkhouse, the guy who's writing this, had been writing Doctor Who comics since Doctor Who Monthly number 53. And the end of Voyager is Doctor Who Monthly number 99.
Wow.
So he'd been writing it for many years at this point, and at the very end, as Astrolabus is, spoiler, dying and saying, well, how do you know how long I might have been writing your life, Doctor? Mm. What are you going to do without me? This is a valediction from Steve Parkhouse, too.
Mm. Very Alan Moore, Grant Morrison, British
exactly.
metafictional stuff.
It is. Yeah. I should also say I've read some stuff after Steve Parkhouse left, and although Frobisher continues for a little while, the quality of the writing, it's pretty dismal. For all of his weirdness, and there's a lot of weirdness, Parkhouse really had his own thing going on. But let's talk about the Maltese Penguin, too. The Maltese Penguin couldn't exist without these stories.
No.
Not only does it use Frobisher, but it specifically brings back elements from this period. Dogbolter.
Dogbolter's the villain again.
Yep.
It goes back to Frobisher being a detective.
Because, yeah, in The Maltese Penguin, he's been traveling for the Doctor for a while, and he decides to give that up and become a private detective again. And so mostly this is his adventure, The Maltese Penguin. One of the fun things about the audio is that the Doctor does pop up every so often.
Yeah.
But he seems like the kind of pathetic friend. It's like, well, I was off saving the universe again. Are you sure you don't want to travel with me, Frobisher? Are you sure?
Nah, Doc, I kind of like my thing.
And then Colin Baker goes limping off again.
You should probably clarify, Frobisher has an American accent. He talks kind of like a stereotypical 1940s private eye.
Yeah.
That's just his natural way of speaking.
There's voiceover and narration in the style of fake Raymond Chandler.
Oh, there's so many homages here. Yeah. There's Raymond Chandler, obviously the Maltese Falcon and Dashiell Hammett. There's a Taxi Driver reference. There's Big Sleep, Peter Lorre, Sidney Greenstreet, Casablanca. It just goes on and on. He riffs on all that stuff.
Yes, it's just all hard-boiled detective stuff put into a big blender and kind of...
And Robert Sherman's really good at blending those things, though. He doesn't linger on one thing too long. He knows how to slip a joke in and move off.
The actors have a lot of fun playing each other. At some point, Colin Baker is playing Robert Jezek playing Frobisher.
Frobisher shape changes into the Sixth Doctor, I guess, to be inconspicuous.
Right.
Okay, whatever. So you hear Colin Baker trying to do sort of an American 1940s accent, and
it's mildly successful.
Yeah.
It works on a meta level because it's Colin Baker doing the acting.
Supposed to be
Frobisher.
Goofy, and it's
Brits playing Americans, Americans playing Brits. Mass hysteria.
What I find funny is that the British idea of what a femme fatale sounds like is still like a Dowager Duchess type of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sounds like Margaret Dumont.
Yeah.
You know? And she's the Lauren Bacall type figure, and she's like, hello, Frobisher.
So, Josh, you want to give our viewers a quick rundown on the plot?
It's an homage to all noir detective plots. There's an item they're looking for, and everyone thinks the other person has it. Dogbolter here is performed as Sidney Greenstreet really well, too. It's a really good Sidney Greenstreet impersonation. But essentially, it's your classic detective story with a backstory here for Frobisher and who the femme fatale ends up being.
Without trying to spoil too much, the femme fatale thing is wobbly thematically. I think the idea of a femme fatale is problematic in the 21st century anyway. It's kind of based on old sexist attitudes. And so new stories that try to do it in the old style, in the old hardboiled detective style, I always kind of have to either do an ironic distance from that or really commit to it. And here, because of the reveal about the femme fatale, which I don't want to get into too much, I think it kind of breaks the story a little bit. The person that the femme fatale is pretending to be is fundamentally incompatible with the person that she really is.
But she's playing a game, and she's playing to Frobisher's fantasy of
being a detective. She's unusually callous for who she turns out to be.
Yeah. Where is it an homage to the plot holes of the material he's spoofing, or where is it plot holes in the spoof? So it is a little hard to tell.
There's a harmonica theme that runs through the whole thing that gets pretty aggravating.
It's the gunfighters song happening over and over again.
But I literally laughed out loud as it was being used over the end credits, and it morphed into a harmonica version of the Doctor Who end credits theme.
I actually rewound it to listen again and went, wait a second.
Yeah, that was hilarious, and I'm sorry I spoiled that joke for everybody who's listening, but I have to, oh God, it's so funny.
And I love the idea of using the hard-boiled narration and contrasting that with the Penguin stuff, because there's so many jokes about, like, I reached my flipper for the glass of bourbon. And as Pat mentioned, the Doctor coming around and trying to get Frobisher to come back with him in kind of a pathetic way is really funny. Robert Sherman is good at the meta jokes. I don't know if this has ever been done before, but the Doctor explicitly makes the reference to all the adventures he's been having without Frobisher. He talks about how he helped the rebels overthrow some corrupt tyrants, and then nipped forward 100 years and found out that all the rebels had become corrupt tyrants in the meantime, and so he then foiled them too. And it's this great reference to the Doctor leaving a situation unresolved, probably just to go back to hell the second he leaves.
Just like Time Lash.
We gotta bring a Victor out here. Which way do you go, Kelvin, then?
I gotta go with the Maltese Penguin. If only because I knew what the hell was happening. I do like European heavy metal type comics of the 70s and 80s, which were crazy, bizarre, and surrealistic and didn't make a lot of sense, but they were like really sort of mentally and visually stimulating. But seeing that approach with Doctor Who rubbed me the wrong way.
This is a real tough one, you guys, because it's hard to compare them for me.
It's very, very weird.
I love Rob Sherman. I love his writing. I liked the Maltese Penguin. I thought some of the hard-boiled stuff was a little easy. And as much as I want to go, hey, Steve Parkhouse, everybody should read these crazy comics, this is not my favorite storyline of his. So it's kind of like the B-team on both sides for me.
Yeah, and they complement one another quite well. I think reading the comic book and listening to that makes the whole experience better. So taking them apart is a little harder.
You know, I'll give it to the Maltese Penguin, because Rob Sherman had the audacity to retcon in the personal reasons that Frobisher is staying a penguin. Because
of that, was pretty satisfying.
I have to give it to that.
Yeah, I have to give it to Maltese Penguin, too, for a more enjoyable experience. I like the artwork, I think, more than the story in Voyager. It's very nostalgic, because I think that was one of the first Doctor Who comic books collected in graphic novel format, like in 1989 or something, and I bought it then. But yeah, the story just washed over me as a kid and kind of still does to a certain degree.
Yeah, something I might have to revisit later. I mean, maybe I just read it a little too quickly.
My takeaway from this, though, is just how intriguing all this alternate media of Doctor Who is, and just how, what a labyrinth of engaging material is out there that is so different.
Guys, I grew up watching Doctor Who. I've seen every single one of the televised episodes. I've read dozens of books. I've listened to dozens of audios. I've read the comics or whatever, and there's still huge sections of it that I'm just unfamiliar with. Looking at Big Finish, I despair of it. There's hundreds and hundreds of stories there, and not even counting the Lightfoot and Jago and the UNIT stuff and the Gallifrey Chronicles and the Dalek Wars and
Faction
the Benny
Paradox
Summerfield and stuff and the Faction Paradox
and the Unbound stories and
the BBV, the Stranger Adventures, the Air Zone, whatever the thing, you know, just, oh my God.
I meant to suggest that this alternate mediums here was a joyous thing, and now
it's,
I feel really burdened.
It's like a
responsibility.
It's because I'm a completist by nature. If I like a William Faulkner novel, I'll read all of William Faulkner's novels, you know, but that is a much easier prospect than trying to comprehend all of Doctor Who, and I've been doing it for 30 years. So
you just said that William Faulkner is easier to comprehend than Doctor Who. I think that's
astounding.
That is amazing.
It's also true.
I hear literature professors having heart attacks all over the world right now.
But there's just not as much of it. That's the thing.
I get it. It's just a pure volume page count.
It's just volume.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yes, I get it.
Okay, so you guys, we're going to talk about more comics in the future because I love the Doctor Who comics. It's underappreciated and I think should be discussed more.
Sure.
But for the time being, I think we have to wrap it up because, oh my God. That's it for this episode of Get Off My World. Next episode, we're going to have a very special guest, local Twin Cities performer Ariel Leaf. The randomizer tells us that we're going to be talking about the Seventh Doctor adventure, Paradise Towers.
Oh, okay.
And in the Death Zone, we're going to be talking about Christopher Eccleston's first adventure, Rose, versus the Seventh Doctor and Ace Big Finish audio adventure, The Harvest, for reasons that Josh will explain to us next time. So until then, I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Miriam.
And we're saying,
get off my world!
Hey, Get Off My World fans, or as I've decided to call you, Get Offers. We've got some exciting news. Get Off My World will be recording a live episode of our podcast at Console Room, the Twin Cities' premier Doctor Who convention, May 29th through the 31st, right here in the Twin Cities, featuring guest of honor Colin Baker, Doctor Number 6. For more information about Console Room, check out the link in our show notes. And if you've been waiting around in hopes of hearing one of our customary outtakes, don't despair. Here's a little something from Kelvin, summarizing this episode's Death Zone discussion.
Blah, 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 Frobisher, blah, blah, blah.